I came here this weekend thinking I was going to minister to you, and you ministered to me. And I want to thank you for that. I feel like Moses coming down from the mountain, and I hope my faith flows for a long, long time. We've come to the part of my life that I would like to call the good year, although it won't seem that way when I first start to tell you, but believe me, these are the autumn years of my life, the good years. You know, for the 26 years that I've been saved, submission has been a real burden for me because it's the hardest thing I think that any of us as women could do. If you are a compliant child, it's easier, but if you are a little rebel, it's a lot harder. But nevertheless, we've all inherited that sin from our sister Eve, and it's difficult. And over the years, I've said every day, I'll be better today. I'll be good. I promise I'm not going to open my mouth. I promise that I won't question. I promise that even when I know my husband's wrong, I won't say anything. But I do. I remember when I first decided I needed a head covering, and it was because the Bible specifically said that it showed that I was submissive to my husband. Even though in my heart I knew that I wasn't. And I've begun to realize that the only way that we can be submissive to our husbands is by first being submissive to the Lord. Being submissive to our husband is an outworking of being submissive to the Lord. We sort of put the horses before the cart. We think that we have to be submissive to our husband and then our lives will be great. But actually, we have it reversed. We need to be submissive to the Lord. We had come back from Pennsylvania and we were back in Vermont and we had our own little home meeting. Bob was teaching, and we would have people come who were visitors to our state who, like you, would come on a vacation and have your directories with you and would see our little home church and come and break bread with us. But as people came and people went from the area, they thought that they needed more. They weren't satisfied with just coming and breaking bread and sharing in the Lord's Supper and worshiping in that simple way. They needed all kinds of programs for their children. So we would have people come for a while, and then they would leave. For the first time in 15 years, 20 years, my husband got a job. And he worked at a little engraving company in the city of Rutland, and he loved it. It was a wonderful little job. He engraved, like, plaques that people wanted for special occasions and trophies. And he could walk to work. And lo and behold, I got a job, too, a permanent job. It was with a law firm because I had been a legal secretary and we were both earning a living. It seemed just amazing to us that we had two incomes now. I walked to work, he walked to work. Life was good. The people that had been our friends for years, although they didn't see that they should come and worship with us, but they had been our real dearest friends for years, who owned the moving company that had moved us around to all these places and had stored all of our belongings for 20 years in this warehouse. One day we got a phone call, and we were told that this wonderful man, this wonderful Christian, had Lou Gehrig's disease, the very disease that my grandfather had died from. Well, needless to say, we were devastated. We were just heartsick. One day, Bob went to work, and his boss said to him, your time is up. Don't even open the machine that you're going to do the engraving on. You're fired. And Bob just couldn't understand it. The man made an excuse that Bob didn't follow some kind of a procedure, but I think it was because Bob had called in a hazmat thing because there was chemicals down the basement, and he had gotten upset, so he called the hazmat team, and the boss did not like the fact that that happened. But actually, the real reason was is that Bob wasn't supposed to work. I look back now, and I know that he was not supposed to have that job. For 6 months, he collected unemployment, and we were back with one salary again, and I asked myself, Lord, is this what my life is going to be like, just being the breadwinner all the time? Am I never supposed to have anybody that's going to take care of me? Can I never just stay home and be a wife? How do women get like that? How do they get to stay home? Must be something I did, right? This is like, I didn't do something right, so I never get to be the one that stays home. 6 months later, I got fired. Now, I never in my whole life was ever fired from a job. I've worked over 40 years. I started work when I was 19 years old, and I'm 61. And except for having my kids, I've always worked. I've always been really good at what I do. So for me to get fired for no reason was a double blow to me. Now, I was collecting unemployment, and the two unemployments weren't a lot. We had no savings. We had no health insurance. We owned a car. We lived in a 600-square-foot apartment. And I thought, all right, Lord, this is very interesting. So what do you want us to do? The answer was that he wanted us to take care of our friend who was dying of Lou Gehrig's disease, who happened to live in Lake George. So we had to travel an hour one way to get to this man's house, who lived within spitting distance of the lake. He had this beautiful house. He had just retired. They had fixed his house up. It was absolutely gorgeous. And he was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. And here he was, he and his wife, sitting there. And so we went to visit him, and the Lord just impressed upon us that we needed to help these people. And as we were deciding to do this, his wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was pretty serious. It was a little far gone. And she said to us, you need to stay, not to stay and live there, but you need to come and help us. She needed to go get a lot of chemo, a lot of radiation. All of her hair fell out. She was sick. She was depressed. And her husband was paralyzed and couldn't speak. And so our vigil started. We would go over to their house on a certain day of the week, and we would stay there and then come home. We had an animal at home that we had to take care of, but he got progressively worse, and only I knew how worse it was going to be because I had watched my grandfather go through the same thing. And I watched my husband, who didn't like smells and didn't like germs and was always very conscious of all kinds of bodily secretions and things, you know. I watched him take this man to the bathroom. and all the things that you have to do with someone who has no use of their hands. I watched him feed him through a feeding tube. I watched him at 3 o'clock in the morning administer pain medication to him. I watched him spell out words on a chart to find out what the man wanted. And there was such grace in that man allowing my husband to do that for him, and my husband in humbling himself to do that for him. It was like the most beautiful picture of two men just submitting to one another in this terrible, terrible time. Meanwhile, his wife was so ill, and we would try to comfort her and take care of her. I cooked the food, although their church in Ticonderoga, New York, brought in food for a year, 3 meals a day. And it went on and went on, and I said, Lord, I know now why both of us don't have any jobs, because you needed us for this. You know, today the hymn that we sang about, is it Hidden Resources? Were those the words, the hidden resources, or the hoarded resources? The things that we hang on to, the things that we think are so essential to our lives. If we don't give them up voluntarily, the Lord will just pry our fingers little by little off of the things that He wants us to give up that are unimportant. And the man died, and the wife lived. And I happen to say today, it was in 2000, she's cancer-free. She's a beautiful Christian. After we buried this man, Bob and I had to go back to Rutland, and we had to face the fact that we had no jobs, and we had no one coming to worship with us, and we thought, well, Lord, what is it that you want us to do? And we had a discussion the other night, Ann and I, about how do you know when it's the right thing to do? How do you know that the Lord is leading you in the right way? Many years ago, when Bob was in Philadelphia College of the Bible, he had, I don't know if any of you have read any of Rennie Schauer's books. He was a professor at Philadelphia College of the Bible, and he was my husband's advisor, because my husband was 50 years old when he went there, so he needed somebody more mature to be his advisor. And he became our friend, and he said, you'll know when the Lord wants you to do something because He will give you peace about it. And in the converse, if it's something that He doesn't want you to do, He will make you very uncomfortable. About this time, there was a very small assembly in Union, Maine, that wanted someone to come and be a teacher. And they notified Bob, and we went there to see what it was all about. And Bob taught, and the elders there said, gee, you know, would you ever consider coming to live here in Union, Maine, and being our teacher? And over the course of about 6 months, every month we would go and Bob would teach, and it was quite a long ride. If I recall, it was at least 6 hour ride to get there. And we'd go there on Friday and come home on Sunday. And it gave us a long time to talk to one another in the car about what we really wanted to do. Bob said to me, what do you think? And I thought, well, I don't know. It would really be a great opportunity for you to teach. And he said to me, well, yes, and there would be women's ministries that you could do too, you know. So we prayed about it. I never told him that I didn't want to go. He never told me that he didn't want to go either. In the middle of the night, I would cry my heart out. And he'd say, now look, we have to give notice on our apartment because, you know, sooner or later we have to make the move here. We have to start packing up what little stuff wasn't already in containers for 20 years. And I could not tell him that I didn't want to go because I did not want to spoil it for him, and that's exactly how he felt about me, which was a very bad thing to do because neither of us were honest with one another. We prayed and we said, Lord, if you want us to go, and I want to tell you that Psalm 86:17 says, show me a sign for good, that they who hate me may see it and be ashamed, because thou, Lord, hast helped me and comforted me. So we pray to the Lord, if you want us to go, find us a place to live there. Now, I have to tell you that the whole east coast of Maine is being bought up by a credit card company called MBNA. It's probably one of the biggest credit card companies in the country, if not the world. And they are reconstructing the coast of Maine. They're buying up these derelict buildings and really making it beautiful. So we prayed, if, and because of that, any little spare garage that anybody has, if they can rent it, they can get a fantastic amount of rent because this credit card company is pulling in people from all over the country to work there and there's no housing. So we said, Lord, if you find us a place to live, we'll go, but we won't go before. And in the meanwhile, a dear sister from that assembly emailed me and said, there's a law firm in Camden, Maine. Now, if anybody's ever been to Maine, you know that Camden, Maine is the picture postcard harbor in Maine. Camden, Maine looks like something out of, I don't know what, it's just beautiful. And on that little harbor was this law firm, and they were advertising for a secretary. Now, Bob and I had said to one another, you won't work. We'll just go there on faith. So the woman said, send them your resume. And I said, well. And I emailed them my resume. And they hired me without seeing me. And they said, can you come for an interview? And I said, sure. And we went. And I didn't really like the place, but I thought, well, you know, maybe this is a sign from the Lord that this is what we're supposed to do. So I said, okay, I'll take the job, and when am I supposed to be here? He said, well, I want you to start September 17th, and this was sometime the beginning of August. So now I was really stuck between a rock and a hard place. We had no place to live, but I had a job. We went home and we gave notice to our landlord to be out by the 15th of the month. I guess I had to start the 19th of September because we had to be out on the 15th and I had 4 days to get from Rutland, Vermont to Maine, set up my stuff wherever we were going to be, and start work 4 days later. The people in the fellowship said, don't worry about it. If you can't find a place to live, you can live in the chapel. We have a little bedroom where a missionary had lived one time. You can live in the chapel. You know, when you go ahead of the Lord, terrible things happen. Terrible things. We had promised the Lord that we wouldn't go without him finding us a place to live. But we were going to take matters into our own hands. So we packed up what we thought should go into storage. And we kept, what could we keep? We needed the books that my husband needed to study from. We needed our clothes. It was going to be September, so we needed summer stuff. We needed winter stuff. We had huge boxes that we call wardrobe boxes with our clothes in it. We had our cat, who was 18 years old and sort of half alive and half dead. My husband rented a Penske moving truck, which gives us cold chills now every time we see one on the road. We put almost everything we had into storage, and we went. I drove the car with the cat and the litter box in the back seat. Bob drove the truck. I cried all the way. We got to this little chapel on a beautiful day, and we unloaded what we had brought, and we tried to get our mattress into the bedroom, and it just barely fit. I think we had about this much space around the bed to get in there. And I wanted to put some of my baking stuff in the closet, but there wasn't enough room. And my stomach began to feel very funny. I almost started to, like, hyperventilate. All the stuff got taken out of the Penske truck. It all got stood in the corner. It would be like all my, if this was the chapel, it would be like all my stuff would be over here, so that on Sunday morning, people would be looking at my personal belongings as they worship the Lord. The people that were there to help us went home, and I looked at Bob, and he looked at me, and I started to cry. And I got into bed. I leaped into bed because I couldn't get to the bed. I had to jump from the doorway into the bed. And there was like a skylight up in the corner, and I watched the sun go or the moon come up and the stars come out, and a terrible shaking came over me. And I shook, and I felt like I was going to be sick. And the worst fear I have ever had in my life came over me. It was like Satan was sitting on my chest. And I thought, what have I done? What have I done? I encouraged my husband to do this. I didn't tell him I didn't want to come. I deceived him. I felt like Eve saying, come on, take a bite. I had deceived him. I had made him feel like everything was okay, but things were terribly, terribly wrong. For the first time in my marriage, for the first time in my Christian life, things were so broken. Things were so out of kilter. I laid awake all night long, sobbing. I said, Bob, we have to go home. I'm afraid. I don't want to stay here. Can you imagine me feeling that way with believers in a fellowship? I was so afraid. I was irrationally afraid. He said, what are we going to do when we go home? We have no place to live. We have no job. We have no money. What are we going to do? I said, I don't know, but we have to go home. The next morning, I called the law firm, and I said, I'm sorry, but I can't come to work for you. And Bob called around to different people that he knew in Rutland, and he said, you know, can you find us a place to live? Do you know if there's any little furnished room or anything that we can come back to? Nobody. Nobody knew. And then we called our friend Joyce out at Lake George. And she said, you have to come to me because I am falling apart. I am so afraid to live in this house without my husband. I need you to come here. And so we loaded everything back into the Penske truck, got back in the car, put the cat in the back who was half dead by this time. And we rode back to Vermont, and as we got there, it was dark, and we came over Killington Mountain, and we could see Rutland down below, the lights all lit, and I just, if I could have gotten out of the car and kissed the ground, I felt like I had been taken back into a place that was safe. And I thought, oh Lord, please forgive me. I will never, ever, ever run ahead of you again. I will never do this again. And something in me that night died. Once in my life, the Lord had taken me to the end of a dirt road to find him. And that night, he took me to the end of myself to keep me with him. We came down and we happened to find, this was foliage season, every motel was booked. We found one last room at the inn that night. And our friend said, tomorrow morning you come over and come and live with me. And we went, and I can't tell you how beautiful this house was on the lake. We had no jobs, we had nowhere to go. She took me for walks every day. In the fall of the year, my favorite time, the trees around the lake were orange and red and gold, and the lake was so beautiful. And for the first time in my whole life, I could just sit with the Lord. It was so quiet. For the first time, I didn't have to go to work. I didn't have to take care of the house. I didn't have to do anything. She took care of us because I was so sick. I was emotionally drained. I looked in the mirror and I thought, I don't even look like myself anymore. I wrote about it in Abigail, but I don't know that you people were getting my newsletter then, but I called it The Dark Side of the Moon because I felt that's where I was for 6 weeks. I was on the dark side of the moon, away from everything. It was like a little womb that I had crawled into. It was so safe. And every day I would sit by the water and I would have my quiet time with the Lord. And it's interesting that we should have talked about that. You should have talked about Mary and Martha, but I am such a control freak. And I related to what you said about you want to have a quiet time, and yes, there we go. And lo and behold, Satan makes your stomach growl. So you say, okay, I'll just go get a little cookie in the kitchen, and then I'll come back. But when you get to the kitchen, something doesn't look quite right there, so you sort of mop it up, and then you think, well, now let me check something before I go back. Before you know it, the time is gone. But at the lake, I didn't have to worry about that. I had no excuses. I had no excuses why I couldn't spend time with the Lord. Nothing really appealed to me anymore that appealed to me before. I didn't stand in front of the mirror. I wrote this in Abigail. I didn't stand in front of the mirror anymore wondering if my stomach was pulled in really well or how I looked in my clothes, because it was a big deal to me to go to work looking very professional. None of those things really made any difference to me anymore. Something had died, and it sort of scared me a little bit because I couldn't reach out and look at that person in the mirror anymore and say, oh, I know you, because I didn't know her anymore. Eventually, we found a place to live. And I want to tell you that the Lord never takes anything away, but he gives back double. We didn't have any jobs. But the Lord found us a place that was half of a double house. It was a duplex. And he found it for the same rent that we had been paying for the 600 square foot apartment. Only this time we had an attic. We had 3 bedrooms. We had a backyard. We had a front porch that I could sit out in, an enclosed porch. One day I looked in the newspaper, and there was a job in there at our local hospital, and I thought, it's a part-time job. I guess I really need a full-time job, but I'll just apply and see what happens. Because now I really didn't care anymore. I wasn't that old go-get-it kind of girl anymore. I didn't care. I was on cruise control now with the Lord. And I got the job. And it's only from 7:30 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon. And so that means I can come home and write Abigail in the afternoon. And it's a perfect job for me. I get to design forms and because I'm such a control freak when it comes to detail, I'm the one that keeps all the policies and procedures in the hospital straight. It was a wonderful job. And I sat in this house and I thought, Lord, you are so wonderful. You took me to the end of myself and then gave me back everything and more. At that time, I decided that I was going to start my day every day with the Lord. Now, I have to be to work at 7:30 in the morning, so that means that I have to get up at 4:15. And I do. My husband makes the coffee. I get up at 4:15, take a shower, because I know if I don't take a shower, I will be half asleep. And I go down, get my coffee, come back up again, and for 1 hour, I spend that time with the Lord in bed with my Bible. And I discovered a wonderful psalm, which I needle-pointed for my living room. And I have to tell you that Psalm 37 is my favorite psalm. Psalm 37:7 says, "Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him." Now, just telling you those words makes me feel like I just came down to this quiet place. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. One day, Bob and I went to visit the warehouse. And we threw away everything in the warehouse that we had there for 20 years. And I have to tell you that it was the most liberating day of my life. There were tools. There were things that I had since I was a kid. There were dishes and knitted afghans and furniture. And I can't even think of all the stuff that took up 3 major containers in here. But we gave it all away. We laid it out on the warehouse floor, and anybody that wanted to come and take that stuff took it. And we were free. Proverbs 8:34 says, "Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at my doorposts." Waiting. Listening. Remember those little twins I told you about that were my friends? When I came back, I resumed my friendship with them, and they were 90 now. 90 years old, still dressing exactly alike. They asked me to be the executor of their wills, and they asked me to be their power of attorney. And one day, one of the twins said to me, "I think I have cancer." And she did. She had pancreatic cancer. And because the other twin wasn't too healthy, she had always taken care of her. They both went into a nursing home close by, and I would visit them twice a day. And eventually she died. So I was solely responsible for this one twin who never had gotten married, had no children. And she lasted for another year and a half, and each day I would go over there and take care of her and see that she was okay and paid her bills and eventually took care of her burial like I had taken care of her sister. And I thought, I know why I came back to Vermont. I know why the Lord scared me back into this state, because he still had things for me to do. And in my stupidity, I had taken his decision, his will, into my own hands. I read somewhere where faith is trained to its supreme mission under the discipline of patience. Psalm 143:8 says, "Cause me to hear thy loving kindness in the morning, for in thee do I trust. Cause me to know wherein I should walk, for I lift up my soul unto thee." We came here today, this weekend, to discuss the presence of God, really. We beg the Lord to listen to us. But you know that He always listens. John 11:42 says, I know that thou always hearest me. Always. I'd like to encourage all of us in this world today to cultivate God's presence so that we don't have to be asking Him to bow down to us, but rather we should reach up towards Him, and that we should know that He is as close to us as our next breath. We are safe here. It's easy to forget that we live in a terrible, horrific world. And I'd like to suggest that we are living in the end time. I'd like to suggest that those of our family and those of our friends who don't know the Lord are scared to death. They have no hope. As I spoke about Moses and his faith and the shining of his faith because he was in the presence with the Lord, I would like to challenge each one of you to cultivate the presence of the Lord so that the radiance of Him will shine forth to others and the peace of the Lord will entice others to us. I'd like to encourage each one of you to set aside a special time of the day to be with the Lord, as Sylvia said in her seminar this afternoon. It's so important. And I know that if you don't do it, the Lord will find a way to make you do it. Because He is jealous for you. He wants you. He wants your undivided attention. And if you don't do it, He will find a way to do it. Each one of us has a challenge before us as we leave this place to be light and to be love and to be life in a dying world. I thank you so much for the opportunity to speak here. I thank you for the warmth and love and nurturing that you gave to me in just 24 hours that will sustain me now for a long time. But remember, the Lord's not far from any of us. Let's close in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, each one of us here today desires to be used by you. Each one of us has our own set of circumstances, especially given to us by you, especially allowed, that nothing that happens to us is by coincidence, but by your hand. Each one of us has our trials, but each one of us will be drawn to you like fine wine aged. I pray that each woman that's here today will go home and will set aside a special time to be with you. Special time to sit and meditate and to have your peace. I thank you for everyone that prepared this weekend's activities, for the people who cooked and planned, and for the wonderful music, and for everything. And I know, Lord, that you will always be faithful to us, and no matter where we go or what we do. And I just thank you for all of it. In Jesus' precious name, amen.